Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend show. Also your hosts on our website and podcast, that is kereport.com and Corlin Economics Report if you're searching in your podcast player. We had another busy week, a lot of daily editorials, a lot of company updates. Please be sure to go back through our website through this past week and click on those market updates as well as company updates, and please share your thoughts with us as we always love hearing what all of you think of the markets and of the stocks we are bringing on. This weekend show, we're going to focus a fair bit on broad markets and also precious metals as always, but I'm very excited to say that we are kicking off the show with Richard Postma, aka Doc, and we will get into precious metals comments, but we're going to make all of you wait for the second segment as I do want to start off more big picture with Doc regarding U.S. equity markets. So, Doc, U.S. markets have shown some weakness through the first month of this year and even blending into February at the tail end of the week. We saw some disappointing earnings out of some of the high-flying tech stocks, especially Facebook, or now known as Meta. This weakness really has a lot of people, I think, more concerned than they usually are because it's happening at the beginning of the month, and it's also tying in with a tightening of central bank policy. Let's just start off high-level, Doc. Your thoughts on the U.S. equity markets. Have we seen the low, or do you think more weakness is to come?
I believe more weakness has come, Corey. We're having a nice little rally, and I think it probably is going to continue the rest of this month. It may not get up to where we saw it at the beginning of January, but I think February will be a month where the markets tend to move grudgingly higher a little bit. And then I think people better be careful about March when everybody's anticipating what the Fed's going to do. So I think we're okay with the conventional markets for the next couple, 3 weeks. We had a little sell-off today, but I don't think that's significant. So we're going to muddle around up here, I think, for most of February.
Well, Doc, it's possible that there's been a slight tone change overall in the markets from 2020 and 2021 as we moved into 2022, because it seemed like for the longest time, the markets could only go up. There was only one direction. Every time there was a pullback to the 50-day moving average, it was bought right back. And almost every sector was at nosebleed valuations to the point where people were saying valuations don't matter anymore. All that matters is the narrative. And now it's not really just January and February. It really started at the end of last year in November and December. Almost every sector that was racing higher, whether it's the meme stocks, the cryptos, the Cathie Wood's ARK Innovations, stay-at-home stocks like the Pelotons and the Zooms, the payment stocks like the Squares and the PayPals, the social media stocks, they've all corrected. The small caps, the Russell 2000. And my question to you is, do you think that we're actually going to see more of a return to sanity as far as how companies are valued, how earnings reports are viewed, and where these things got to in valuations versus where they really should have been in valuations? Do you think we'll see a return to more of a focus on valuations?
Yes, I do. And I think in the future that the value stocks will outperform over the growth stocks. And already we're seeing some of these growth stocks start to get hit in different areas like biotech and some of the NASDAQ stocks. You know, a lot of these stocks were at nosebleed level, and the profits did not justify those levels. And so when they just miss a little bit, everybody's edgy now. When they miss a little bit, you just get a tremendous tremendous sell-off, like we've seen with Netflix and Facebook. There's more to come, as far as I'm concerned. So I think going forward in the next year, growth stocks will get hit pretty hard, I believe. Value stocks, of course, initially with a general market sell-off, will also pay a price. But value stocks, on a comparative basis, I believe, will do better. And I also believe that commodities will probably go into a trading zone and maybe sell off a little bit because of the increase in rates by the Feds. But commodities will hold up better than, I believe, the growth stocks. And the third area, I think, to look for are the emerging markets, which have really gotten crushed, most of them. I think they will do better than the U.S. markets.
Doc, how much of this weakness that we are seeing broadly in U.S. equity markets are simply due to the fact that central banks are going through a tightening process? This week we heard from the BOE, the Bank of England, as well as the ECB. It was just the last week that we heard from the Fed. And overall, outside of, I guess, the People's Bank of China, central banks are getting tighter, and that is pulling some of that liquidity, that additional liquidity that kept getting added month after month out of these markets. I know it's too easy of an answer, but is this the main driver behind this weakness right now?
Absolutely, Corey. And also, I might say, them taking away the stimulus money that they pumped into the economy in 2021, but it's primarily the action of the central banks. When these traders and people that invest based on just money printing, when you start to take that away from them, it makes a lot of them very nervous. Plus, I think the other factor is once they get nervous, margin debt adds to that nervousness, and it's at an all-time high. And that's just going to add to the problem going forward. But I think it's primarily just the threat of decreasing liquidity is what's starting to change this market right now.
Well, Doc, I think that's a good point about the margin debt that you just brought up, because we also saw over the last 2 years, record amounts of new investors come into the markets for the first time. People opened trading accounts for the very first time. They were stuck at home. They decided maybe they were out of job or maybe they were working from home, and they decided, you know what, I'm going to start trading. And a lot of them had a pretty easy start. And now that we've seen a lot of that money evaporate, I'm wondering if things like record amounts of margin, or we also saw record amounts of insiders selling at the end of last year in Q4 and in Q1. And when you see insiders selling, they're kind of signaling to the markets that, hey, you know, we think this may be the top for the short amount of for the short period. Do you think that we're going to see some investors shy away from buying the dip until we get more clarity on whether these Fed rate hikes are going to take the markets down into a more prolonged, maybe even recession?
Yes, I think what we're seeing in some of these other sectors, in the high growth stock sectors and the small caps, and what we've seen happening there and the carnage in biotech and other areas, I think it plays a psychological impact on investors, some of whom have never seen a really good bear market. And I think that they start to back off. And this buy the dip mentality, we had some buying recently on this, the move down in January, but a lot of that was probably short selling, not true buying with a feeling that, oh, now we're going to go higher again. So I think a lot of that was short selling. So I think the buy the dip mentality is being compromised right now. And I think we're going to see that more and more as we go forward.
All right. Well, Doc, let's switch focus then into the precious metals market, because I know a lot of our audience really wants to hear your outlook for precious metals. And there was one comment that you made on the blog, I believe it was this week, that really took me, not necessarily by surprise, but I noted it pretty heavily in my mind, and that is the fact that you've moved into 90%, even more than 90% cash right now. Give us your thoughts why you're in so much cash right now and not in precious metal stocks.
Well, because, Corey, I said back in December, and I always try to walk my talk, and I said back then that we're going to have to be cautious about just about every asset class going into 2022. I frankly don't see any good place to put money right now in this environment. And so that's why I'm in the amount of cash I am. And I'm waiting for precious metals to bottom eventually, and they will. I'm glad I've been patient, because they continue to move down, a lot of them. Some of them are pretty close to their bottoms, especially the juniors, and some of them have already reached it, by the way. But there are some mid-tiers and also large-cap stocks yet that have to get there, so I'm in no hurry. And the fact that the juniors have been hurt tells you that the other ones, the mid-tiers and some of the large-cap, are still at risk with time, and so I'm just biding my time. And when I do get back in the market, I'll start mentioning it on your website when I get more aggressive. But I believe we aren't there yet.
Well, Doc, based on that and the fact that the gold price and the silver price really aren't breaking down, they're not breaking out, but they're not breaking down either. They're kind of just stuck in a range. But the stocks have really been hit hard. When you do start positioning with some of that cash, are you going to go for some of the smaller juniors that are already beat up by 60 to 70%? Or will you jump into some of those producers and those mid-tiers that tend to move first in the cycle? How will you be positioning when you do start deploying cash?
I will take percentages of where I'm at and put a percentage in each of those levels. I'll probably stay away from large cap. I'm just not a large cap person. I feel your returns can be so much better in mid-tier and in some of these juniors that particularly are still good companies, and they can move really phenomenally compared to a large cap corporation. And so I'll probably stick to mid-tier mostly. I'll buy a little bit of the major producers, but I like to stay with the mid-tier and the juniors with some large caps sprinkled in there.
Doc, how long do you think you're going to be largely out of the market? Because in all fairness, being that high in cash, you are taking a very defensive strategy. Any general time frame that you think things could improve where you will get more aggressive?
I think by pretty much June, I think... on a lot of these will have found their bottoms, even the mid-tiers, by June. And then I think what will happen after that is I think they're going to develop trading ranges at the bottom for a while, and they'll move up and down then. But the trading range will show you that they have established it. And that's, I think, based on what I'm seeing on the charts, the best time to buy is going to be in the first half of this year, but more toward the second quarter.
Well, Doc, just to play the other side of it, because as you know, I don't think it's a secret. I'm very fully deployed. I'm probably as deployed in the mining stocks as you are in cash. So we're kind of on different ends of the teeter-totter. So my question would be, you know, in a friendly sense, what if the markets actually start taking off in March when the Fed starts hiking rates? Are you at risk of being in too much cash and then needing to chase some of these stocks higher? Because we know when they move, they can really move quick. So is that a risk that you're taking?
It is a risk. But looking at my technicals right now, the odds of that happening, I think there's going to be an exception to that rule this year. And I know people have talked about that. But because of the inflation and other situations we're in, I think you may not see that this time. And I can tell usually when a breakout is happening, and we are so low now, it doesn't matter if I wait, because I can take, you know, a fairly good position quite quickly in these stocks and we'll still be 80% off the highs. So I'm not too concerned about that, actually, Shad. And but I'm watching my charts very closely for that possibility, because you are correct. There is always that possibility, and I certainly entertain that.
Doc, what's your assessment of how low the volumes have been in a lot of these stocks? We've gotten comments on both sides. The one side, obvious comments of, look, low volumes mean lack of interest for these stocks and the sector. The other side saying, oh, all the sellers are washed out, so the downside is limited because we're seeing lower volume and no one's willing to sell anymore. I always argue that if a stock is anywhere above zero, there can be more selling, but that's also just more of a negative outlook on things. What's your assessment, though, of the lower volume in the stocks?
Well, some of these stocks, actually, if you look, the last 2 years, the volume has been pretty heady, and it still is. And some of them are starting to tail off now. And if you look at past history, when that happens, I think you're going to see more and more of that, by the way. When you see that, it's a multi-month period before we get a good run again. So, but some of the volume has really, when you look at the monthly charts on some of these, have been pretty impressive for 2 years. And but I am seeing the volume starting to tail off, especially in some of these stocks that are juniors. And once that starts to happen, if you look historically at these runs, you'll see that happen. And then you're talking about a multi-month, you know, lower volume time frame where these stocks just kind of settle down. And by the way, I think when we settle down on a lot of these stocks, it's not going to be like March 2020, where we just had a sudden drop and then we took off again. I think when we find the bottom, most likely pretty close to mid-year, it's not going to suddenly take off. I think we've had so much damage here that it's going to take time to equilibrate these things. And so people will be able to pick and choose what they want to get back into.
Well, Doc, just one question about what you think may start moving first. I mean, generally, the accepted view is that you'll see gold move first, and then eventually silver will come along, and then the mining stocks. But we've also seen different time periods where the miners and silver actually led gold lower and led gold higher. Which one are you going to be looking to break out, or which one do you think will break out first? Will silver and the mining stocks lead the charge higher ahead of gold and sniff it out early? Or do you think it will take gold finally breaking out in price above 1900 to get more momentum?
I think it'll be gold because I think second half of the year, we're going to see the change inflation, the rate of inflation quieting down finally. So that'll be disappointing at first. But I think they're not going to be able to get inflation back to the base level before we've had this recent run. It'll be probably a stair step higher. And then when they have to stimulate this economy again, which I think will slow down, but it'll slow down gradually. I think when they have to stimulate it again, I think gold's going to be the preferred spot to be versus silver. But silver will catch a bid then too.
All right, Doc, we're wrapping it up here. Thank you for spending the first two segments with us on the weekend show. Always interesting to hear what your strategy is, and I think very interesting to hear just how defensive you're being here and how you think that a wide range of market sectors are going to be under pressure for at least the first half of this year. Again, mostly based on tightening cycles by a lot of the central banks. Doc, hey man, great having you on the show. Thanks again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope you all enjoyed those first two segments with Richard Postma. I know some of the gold bugs haven't liked some of Doc's calls when it comes to the precious metals, but boy, oh boy, he has been fairly accurate through the many years that I've been chatting with him. Another person that has been very accurate in calling some of the recent market moves is Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago. Now, Dana, last time we had you on the show, you were, I think I can say, fairly bearish on the broad markets. And this is coming off of a time when I know a lot of people were pointing bearishly at the broad averages because of some of the weak breadth readings we were seeing about two-thirds of the way through last year. You were still on the bullish side, saying you still saw some upside in the markets, and you were spot on in that, where the markets did continue to go higher, and really their most recent all-time high, at least for the S&P, was pretty much right at the turn into 2022. Now we are seeing weakness. And in all fairness, as I said, last time you were on the show, you were bearish. We've seen a fairly healthy sell-off here in markets, but it hasn't even been that long of a sell-off in terms of time frame. What do you think, Dan? Are we at or at least close to a more solid bottom for the markets?
Thanks, Corey. Well, I think from a shorter term basis, last week we saw a good capitulatory low, at least again, on a short term basis. We saw three things that we like to see. We saw key technical levels tested and held. We saw extreme bearishness in terms of investor sentiment. We saw including some all-time, some historically high hedging readings, whether it's from the options market or inverse ETF market. Saw a ton of hedging activity. Also, we saw some washout readings in terms of breadth measures. So things like new lows, especially in the NASDAQ. I know there are a lot more issues now, but even on a percentage basis, we saw, you know, one of the five highest levels of new lows on the NASDAQ that we've seen since the crash of 87. So we did see sufficient evidence of at least a near-term capitulatory low last week. Now we're seeing, since then, we've seen a really nice bounce, which we expected. We did cover shorts last week into this bounce. We expected it just to be a reflexive or retracement bounce ahead of another retest of last week's lows, or potentially another wave down. So that's unknown, but without a doubt, I think the bounce we've seen over the last week or so is definitely one to be sold into or even shorted.
Well, that's an interesting perspective, Dana, because there's a lot of the mainstream media is proclaiming that we've had our low now, and now that this bounce is just the beginning of the next leg higher. But the way you're looking at it, you see it more as a relief rally then, that maybe there's a little bit room left to the upside, but would you be shorting it here then if you expect it to go down and retest the previous lows or possibly break to a new low?
Yeah, well, we did start shorting it again yesterday. So we have some significant hedges back on as of yesterday with the S&P and the Dow, especially reaching some key resistance levels yesterday in the chart. So we're getting a big sell-off today from those levels. Whether that bounce is over or not, I can't definitively say, because we do have potential further upside here in the near term in the smaller cap, in the Russell 2000, the broader measures. Whether that move comes to fruition, we do see a further bounce here, I'm not sure. If we do, we will continue to sell and continue to more aggressively short this bounce ahead of, like I said, an expected retest or even a new down leg.
Dana, how worried do we have to be about a crash scenario here where money has already started to shift out of the markets, even into more defensive positions? What if it picks up steam and the bottom just drops out?
Well, I mean, it's certainly possible. You've seen what prevents that from occurring usually is a strong technical or fundamental an internal foundation below the market, especially in terms of broad constructive technical patterns in the broader market of stocks. We've seen pretty much that foundation taken away after we tried to break out in late October, early November in the broader market, and then the things like the advanced decline lines. Those breakouts immediately failed, and since then we've seen slow or steady, I should say, deterioration in terms of breadth, in terms of the internals, in terms of the broad market, even as the averages held up into the new year, as you mentioned. So we've seen a substantial amount of deterioration below the surface, which removes a lot of that support, a lot of that that foundation that would prevent a serious, like a crash type scenario, or at least continued waterfall type decline. So we did see that washout, the capitulatory near-term low last week. That doesn't mean that it can't eventually be broken and continue to see lower lows. So I would say just removing that foundation technically within the broader market does introduce the possibility that we could continue to waterfall decline after whatever near-term bounce or reflexive bounce runs its course here.
Well, Dana, when you say that you saw that capitulatory low last week because of some of the sentiment readings, because of some of the metrics you were watching, what would you be looking for to symbolize that it really is the major low, at least for a short for the medium term? Because obviously we've had that bounce out of those conditions. Would you expect the sentiment readings to get even worse? Would you expect there to be even more 52-week lows and even worse breath readings? What would be the signal for you that it's kind of an all clear to go long again?
I would expect on a retest of those last week's lows or even a slight undercut of those lows. And in fact, in the S&P 500, I would expect a slight undercut of those lows. And in terms of the breath and sentiment readings, I would expect to see readings that are not as bad as last week. So kind of a positive divergence in terms of breath and sentiment. That would give me more confidence that it might be a successful retest and we could put in a more substantial and more sustainable bounce. If we do see higher or worse readings in terms of breath, in terms of sentiment, then that's indicative of potential further or next down wave that takes us well below last week's low. So that'll be something that's a good question. That'll be something that certainly we'll have our eye on.
So Dan, are you looking at any other markets or sectors to give you a bit of a heads up on if that weakness or if another breakdown is going to come? I'm thinking mostly bond market, maybe if interest rates continue to rise and that tightens a little bit of the free money available, or currencies or other international markets. Anything else that you're looking at to give you some heads up on where that next move is going to go?
Well, it's interesting that we're not seeing, you know, the typical flight to safety in the bond market. We're seeing yields spike today, even as stocks sell off. So that is an interesting and probably not a comforting move in the markets to see. And if we do see rates continue to spike up, they're testing, you know, long-term highs right now. If they do continue to spike, that might even exacerbate the selling even more in the stock market, to be honest. So that is typically you're seeing some sort of, I would even call it, you know, bonds aren't typically a sufficient hedge in terms of one stock portfolio in a nasty correction like this. But at least you're seeing money pouring in somewhere. Right now, we're not even seeing that. So I would be even more concerned if we do see a breakout in rates, which I expect that we will see eventually, whether it's very shortly or down the line a little bit. But that is one aspect of this sell-off that is unusual in recent years, certainly. And like I said, not very comforting indication if you are a bull.
Well, speaking of hedges and the bonds, I wonder about the precious metals, what your outlook there is, Dana. I would have expected a little bit more of a bid into gold in particular, just with all the weakness across so many sectors, but it really has been stuck in a channel and a range. It hasn't really done much. What's your outlook on gold for the maybe short to medium term?
Well, you hit it on the head. It hasn't done anything for many, many months, maybe a year. So, our longer term, we are bullish on the precious metals complex. We think last year or the 2020 high was a test of the high from last decade, and we're just working off that rally now and consolidating that rally now, and eventually we do move on to new highs. When that is, I'm not sure. I'm not particularly bullish or bearish on gold. And a little slightly bearish on silver right here. But like I said, it's pretty much in a trading range right now. I think the miners, after we thought they might be breaking out a little bit a couple of weeks ago, pulled the rug out from under the miners again. So especially if the stock market continues to correct, the miners certainly will not be probably a safe haven unless gold and silver start taking off to the upside. So that I would not be hedging stock market risk in the miners, but gold and silver, you know, they're going at their own pace. Eventually, I do expect another big up leg. When that starts, I'm not sure.
Sounds like broadly, Dana, you're just seeing weakness almost across the board, or at least a lack of strength in any sector. Does that simply have to do with, I know you don't like following this, but central banks changing course, money becoming a bit tighter, and, well, there just isn't that much money out there as compared to last year. So markets broadly in most sectors tend to correct.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, listen, if you remove the Fed put, at least shrunk the size of the Fed put in the immediate term, I think the Fed has made it clear that they're not going to change course from their thinking anytime soon. So in the immediate term, that removes a lot of the confidence, a lot of the perhaps liquidity that would normally be propping up not just stocks, but a lot of the assets. So in the near term, I think that makes it psychologically, it makes it very difficult for long investors in most markets.
It really does. And that's the big change for this year. And we're all guessing as to how long the Fed will go through the tightening process and, quite frankly, how the markets are going to react. But right now, we are getting markets broadly pricing in the tightening. And, well, that's causing a bit of weakness in slower markets, especially the lack of upside movement. Dana, thank you again for your time. As always, great having you on this weekend show again. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend, and we'll chat again in another couple weeks.
Thanks a lot. Take care, guys.
Welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We're going to switch focus a little bit from simply talking about the markets and metals and a lot of the technical outlooks that we have gotten for the first part of this weekend show, as we are now chatting with Brian Lenny, founder and editor of the Junior Stock Review website, also writes a premium newsletter. We're going to dive a bit more into one key characteristic to consider when assessing juniors, majors, really any resource company. That term is jurisdictional risk. So where the asset is located for any company that you're thinking of investing in. Now, Brian just went and rejigged his top five recommendations or stocks that he likes in the junior space. And this is what got us thinking about jurisdictional risk, because I believe, Brian, you had a couple questions come in from your subscribers saying, how do you weigh jurisdictional risk when you do outline your top stocks? So when we talk about jurisdictional risk, we always talk about kind of the negatives. And a lot of people shy away from whether it's West Africa, whether it's South America, whether it's even California in the U.S. There are a number of jurisdictions that do have kind of a negative indentation in terms of not being able to get stuff done. Brian, let's start off high level here. How much importance do you put on jurisdictional risk?
Thanks for having me, Corey. Jurisdictional risk is a big component of the analysis I do for any company. Jurisdictional risk is very real. With that said, I think jurisdictional risk, you know, can also bring opportunity. You know, there's situations where a country's reputation maybe doesn't necessarily represent what's going on in the country at a given moment. And at those times, I think that those discounts that the market gives certain companies are great opportunities. And I think there's a number of countries out there right now that present good opportunity for investors that, you know, first, you know, they understand the jurisdictional risks that are associated with that country, but then also are able to take a look at the company in general and say, okay, it's worth, you know, X amount of dollars, and this is what the actual price the market's giving it. And if that price to value ratio is in the right, you know, realm of whatever your specific specs are, and you're comfortable with the jurisdictional risk and where that country is at the moment, I think those are opportunities, and those are opportunities on how you can make a lot of money. And I have in the past, and I plan to in the future. And like you said, I did some rejigging with the top five and a couple of the questions that were posed, because, you know, one company in particular in the top five is located in West Africa, particularly Ivory Coast. And so the reader wanted to kind of understand why I was comfortable with Ivory Coast. And so it spurred this kind of two-week expose on jurisdictional risk. And I talked about why, you know, I think that it's opportunity in Ivory Coast right now. While there's always risk, the opportunity to me is right. And I think that, you know, I'm talking about Montage Gold here. And I think that that's going to be a company that is going to be a success for the portfolio in the end.
Well, Brian, it's interesting to get into this topic of jurisdiction risk, because after over a decade in the space myself, and as someone that invests in West Africa, I'm always interested in how certain people will only invest in, let's say, North American companies, and they shun all the whole continent of Africa as if it's one uniform blob. And the reality is, investing in South Africa in a platinum mine is totally different than investing in copper or cobalt in the Congo or in Eritrea. When there was NEVSUN was operating there, and that's totally different than West Africa. And all of the countries in West Africa are different, even down to the local level. And there's a lot of success stories in West Africa, but they're often trading at a discount. So you brought up Montage in Ivory Coast, but the reality is they've got about 4 million ounces of gold. They've got a massive development project. And if that was in Canada, it would be valued probably at 5 or 6 times where it is now. So are there times where you just see jurisdiction risk has been overweighted to the downside, and it presents a compelling value proposition for investors that see what the assets are in the ground?
Oh, definitely. And again, like Montage is a really good example of that. But there's a number, like Ivory Coast, I think Ghana is probably underrated, especially when you put in perspective of how many senior mining companies operate out of Ghana, and how much gold is actually produced out of that country on a given year. Like, it's a top 10 producer in the world for gold. And I think, you know, people miss that. Obviously the country is very important to the global gold supply, and it's very important to some of the biggest mining companies in the world. Newmont, I think, has around 15% of their operations or gold production comes out of Ghana. So obviously, you know, it's an important country, and even though there are risks, you know, the risks are real. That's one thing I don't want to, you know, understate, is the fact that the jurisdictional risk is real. Like, things can happen. We saw Burkina Faso. Things have been brewing in the north of Burkina Faso for a number of years. I can remember a couple of years ago looking at a few different companies in Burkina and kind of shying away because of what was going on in the north. And, you know, lo and behold, last week we see a military coup, and, you know, maybe or maybe not that'll kind of fix things in within the country. But there's some specific things about Burkina that I think add to the chaos that sometimes arises there. And but I still wouldn't, you know, besides not probably investing in the heart of the north of Burkina, I wouldn't shy away from investing in the right story in Burkina Faso if the price to value was there in my favor. So like I said, you need to understand what's going on in those countries, and it can change on a dime. But if you're able to have maybe a longer time horizon and can kind of jive with some chaos, you know, here and there, I do think that there's opportunity, like you said. And a lot of the times, like in Ivory Coast right now, I think the country is very stable. And I think that larger mining companies are looking to expand operations, especially the ones that are already operating there.
So I think one key thing to touch on here, and you've kind of alluded to it, is that, look, companies or jurisdictions do carry this risk, and you're not playing these companies because you think jurisdictional risk will wane. You're playing these companies because you like the asset and you don't think that the jurisdiction is so bad that essentially the asset is going to get simply taken away from the company. Is that fair to summarize it that way?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. And that's, yeah, the fundamentals of the company have to are first and foremost. And, you know, the value has to be there. You know, you have to see that as like a top tier project. Like, I don't think you want to go into some of the riskier or the termed or viewed riskier jurisdictions for marginal projects necessarily. Like, I think that could be the recipe for disaster, because those projects typically aren't going to bring you money unless the market is rocking. And I mean, like in a bull type mentality, meaning all boats are sort of rising. And, you know, for anybody who's been a resource sector investor for long enough, they know that we're typically in a sideways or bear market you know, most of the time, or else most of the time I've been an investor. So you need to stick to those top companies and look for deposits that are, you know, top tier. I'm not going to use the term world class because it is overused, but you want to look for top tier projects. Going back to Montage, it's a company we talked to before. Their production profile puts them, you know, head and shoulders above, you know, a lot of juniors out there. And I think that's what senior mining companies are going to be looking for. You know, those 150,000, 200,000 ounce per year production capacities. And, you know, all the other things align with it too. But, you know, that's kind of what I think separates it from the rest of the crowd and, you know, puts it in that upper echelon. And that's the kind of stuff I think that if you're going to take some risk, that's what you're going to look for. Like the reason why people go to Congo is like, look what Friedland's done with Ivanhoe in Congo. You know, Kamoa-Kakula is some of the highest grade that we've seen, like these multiple percent copper deposits, Platte Reef deposits. Like these things aren't found around the world. These are top tier and in that realm, world class type of deposits. You should look at taking risk for world class deposits, because at some point, you know, these things are going to be developed. And that's what a guy like Friedland has done. And he bought the thing on the cheap. Another great example, and it was the example I used back when I did a presentation at PDAC in the Sunday Letter Writer presentations on Ecuador. You look for those bottoms when sentiment is the worst in these countries. Like Ecuador is the example I used. And to me, the bottom was marked when Kinross sold Fruta del Norte to Lundin Mining for $250 million. That's 80% off the sticker. It's 80% off the $1.2 billion they paid Aurelian when they bought it. And, you know, if you want to compare more quantitative numbers, if you look at the Fraser Index, if you go back and you look at, I think it's 2012 or something like that when they sold it, you looked at the Ecuador Fraser Index, that's when it bottomed itself. And then you saw it ramp back up. You know, Castillo got bumped out as president. They brought in a new, maybe center right or right wing, however you want to look at it. But things started to change and they got rid of the windfall tax. And then you saw a huge influx of money. So the Lundin started it off, but then you saw BHP, Newcrest. I think Anglo American came in there with a deal, the JV. So you saw a few hundred million dollars get pushed into the country as things started to change. That ramp up and flow of cash is stuff that you want to look for a change in overall sentiment in a country. And then if you can find a top tier junior that fits your risk criteria and you know, has a good outlook, then I think that those discounts to value are the positions you want to take. And the one thing I'll say, and you said it in your comment, you know, these jurisdictions never really change, in my view. There's just periods of time where they become more attractive. And those are the times you want to take advantage of.
Yeah, Brian, you make some great points there. And I just want to quickly contrast the West African jurisdictions to the South American jurisdictions to the point you're making. You brought up Burkina Faso, and there's so much worry about the northern side of the country. But it should also be pointed out that so many investors in North American stocks are waiting for their prize stock to be taken over by the big boys. But look at what happened in Burkina Faso just in the last few years. We've seen Griffin Minerals taken over. We've seen True Gold taken over. We've seen Teranga taken over. We've seen Simafo taken over. We've seen Rocks Gold taken over, all in Burkina Faso, the quote unquote risky place. Then why in the world are there so many takeovers there? And I was in several of those takeovers where there was amazing premiums to be made. And the sentiment couldn't be worse towards the country. And then you think about countries like Peru and Chile that are celebrated as longtime copper and longtime base metals producers. And just this week, Chile talked about nationalizing its copper and lithium mines. Peru has a very far left political person in there that's potentially going to tax the crap out of the companies that are in there. And a lot of the projects are getting blocked by local groups. Venezuela is a basket case. Argentina has currency issues. Ecuador is very cyclical, like you mentioned. So when you compare these jurisdictions, sometimes there's a favor given to one because of the history. But at the same time, that doesn't stop the majors from going in and buying quality projects when they see quality.
Oh, you're absolutely, you hit the nail on the head. And you know, I think that's what first and foremost, everybody has to do their homework. You've obviously done it because you've rhymed off some very good points and comparisons. And yeah, it's funny how the market, I would say, does tend to favor probably South America over Africa in general, not only just West Africa. Yet, if you look at the flow of money in senior mining companies, at least in the gold sector, you're right. West Africa has probably seen much more money inflow and much more action on the M&A front than we've seen in South America. And, you know, honestly, I think the more I've studied the South American countries and really just started in looking at West Africa. But, you know, I do see trouble in South America on the horizon. I think there's some troubling trends, and Chile and Peru are, you know, have gone from the number one ranked countries within South America to probably near the bottom of many people's lists. Now, we'll see where that all goes, because I think there's something to say for, you know, in Chile, for instance, besides this latest news that talk about nationalization, which would be absolutely horrible. But a lot of people, investors that I know, they say that they won't cook the golden goose, meaning, you know, the copper is really what keeps Chile's economy pumping and up amongst the best in South America. So if they killed that, what would they do? Now, I tend to agree. I think that, you know, most sensible governments aren't going to want to destroy that, but it sounds like they could go to the extreme and nationalize it, and that it would be terrible, and that would be my worst fear of Chile realized. And honestly, that's one of the reasons why I sold the Chilean company last year, was because when they start talking about rewriting a constitution, this is serious stuff. And so we'll see where that goes. But I completely agree with you. There is a disconnect. And I think that mostly has to do with people doing their homework. It has more to do with people reading headlines and then creating a judgment or a thought in their head rather than actually looking at what's going on. And honestly, I think investors right now, just go take a look at the gold production out of Ghana. Ghana is very important to the senior mining companies. And I think it's going to continue to be that way. And I think the disconnect is opportunity for the investors that do their homework and have a sensible thought on what the risks are and what the price to value ratio is on the specific company that they want to invest in.
All right, final quick question here, Brian. We hear a lot about the Fraser rankings, the Fraser Institute rankings on jurisdiction when it comes to mining. We hear a lot about it from companies in, let's say, Nevada, because Nevada is always ranked really high. So they're saying Fraser Institute always ranks this as one of the highest or the best places to be as a mining company. Do you use these rankings at all, driving more down to some of these somewhat more riskier jurisdictions as a barometer for interest and where the country is going?
Generally speaking, no. In the last couple of years, I haven't used them at all. If you go back to earlier in my, you know, career as a full-time investor, yeah, I would pay more attention to the rankings. But more and more, I do my own research and come up with my own idea of what I'm dealing with. Like I said, like I try to look at the culture of the society, the government, the geography of the country, the infrastructure present in it, and then timing and cash flow into the countries. And that's kind of why I have come up with my own sort of ranking. At this moment, I don't quantify it, but I do look at those five or six components and try to get an idea of what I think the country is all about. And I think that's what you have to do, because there's holes. When you try to quantify something as big as jurisdictional risk, there's too many holes. And the other side to it is each company is so different. Like I said, like the underlying fundamentals of the company, I think, are first and foremost. And then you look at those other kind of components, if you maybe the more qualitative, like jurisdictional risk, and see how that threads in with that price to value proposition. That's just the way I go about it. I'm sure there's people that do it differently, but I've had success doing it the way I do it.
All right, Brian, really appreciate you taking time on this weekend show. And hey, we appreciate all of you for tuning in throughout this weekend show. Again, be sure to please go back, listen to the daily editorials that we posted this week, as well as the company updates. And feel free to email us at any time. My email is fleck@kereport.com. Shad's email is shad@kereport.com. Please share with us your thoughts on the markets and any companies that you're interested in or would like us to get some of your questions answered for you, we are here to help and happy to help in any way we can. Brian, thank you again for your time. Everybody, I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks for having me, Corey.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.